problem just about every major city in the country now seems to be facing is traffic. And this is an important enough issue that we're going to talk about it a few times this season. Because yeah, it's annoying, okay? It's a time drain and it's a health issue with all that pollution. It's probably also a mental health issue. But I think it also just illustrates really well our failure to plan our cities for growth. I mean, I would say at this point, our actual refusal to plan our cities for growth. Back around 2017, 2018, plan of Elon Musk's to tunnel under LA, even while supported by the mayor, was met with intense backlash from both media and a bunch of, quote, community groups, which I just, by the way, separately, really have an issue with. In San Francisco, we have a lot of groups like this, and they are right now prohibiting everything from vital infrastructural development to housing. And it's crazy, right? I mean, we are all a part of this, quote, community, but I do not recall anybody asking me how I felt about new housing, because the answer is, yeah, let's build a lot of it. And I think the answer for probably most people in our city would be that we need more housing. But that housing is a slight digression. We're going to get to it a little later this season. In the meantime, what do we do about this traffic? Probably the big tech story related to all of this for the last handful of years has been self-driving cars. And in this episode, that's where I want to start.
My name is Delian Esperohov, and I'm a principal at Founders Fund.
So Delian is a colleague of mine, of course. Before that, he was a principal at Coastal Ventures, the head of growth at Teespring, and the founder of a healthcare company called Nightingale. He's put a lot of thought into self-driving car technology, recently led an investment in the space, and so I wanted to sit down with him and get a kind of lay of the land. What does all this look like right now? What would it look like if it were working perfectly? Would it have any impact on traffic? That's sort of an open question, I think. If not, why is this important? And a handful of other things. We talked about tech risk broadly, shortening feedback loops on human decision-making, collecting data for self-driving cars, all the different approaches here, and artificial intelligence. Why it seems like all of this has gone a little slower, frankly, than folks were hoping a few years back, and how it's shaping up today. So let's get into it. From Founders Fund, I'm Mike Solana, and this is Anatomy of Next. On the companies with technical risk or large technology risk, do you feel there are as many now as there were a few years ago or less? What is the landscape there?
I would say that it is steadily increasing. And I think that's happening for a variety of different reasons. I'd say there's probably number one, which is the sort of heroes of the world now, I think, embody more technical risk than they used to, right? Like, I think, you know, founders were obsessed with like the Steve Jobs of the world, which yes, had some like quote unquote, like, you know, technical chops, but he was design, vision, yeah, et cetera, versus now the like, you know, beloved hero is Elon, and Elon's the sort of geeky, not wearing turtlenecks, but just like super technical founder. And so I think the people that feel like they fit that image now realize that they can be more of founders. I think there's also just like more, I think in some ways, so that's maybe the supply side of the actual like founders being willing to go after those problems. But I do also think on the sort of like capital side, there are just far more people that are comfortable with that. If you look, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there just weren't investors investing into rockets and robots, at least private investors. This was entirely in the world of like defense, right, even as late as like, you know, let's say 10 to 15 years ago. You know, there was definitely
in the Founders Fund.
Yeah, Founders Fund. I would say, you know, started in the 06, let's say 07 era when people were started going after the like, you know, green tech world. And obviously biotech with like way back in the day, Genentech, KPCB in the 70s, obviously invested in that. It's not like it's only the recent era, but it feels like in the much more recent era, there's a significant acceleration in sort of founders being interested in going after technical risks.
Yeah. What do you think are the clearest low-hanging fruits of the technology risk startups?
Oh, man. I have this overall hypothesis that a lot of sort of, and this is definitely influenced, I would say, heavily by Keith, which is that a lot of sort of human decision-making for how to be healthier, fitter, stronger, live longer, we know what we need to do. We know what the right advice is and things you should be doing. But the problem is the feedback loops are super, super long. Yeah. So let's take just the example of like going to the gym, right? Everybody knows that you should go to the gym, but you go there for, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks when you're out of shape, you don't feel like you're seeing any results. And so it's like just super hard to continue to motivate yourself because the feedback loop is you have to go to the gym for, let's say, 6 months before everybody notices and they give you compliments. And those compliments then like give you that feedback where, you know, you stick with the habit and want to do it long term. But that problem is actually super easy to solve with computer vision. You can analyze somebody's body, and after just like 1 to 2 weeks of working out, you can actually show them micro changes and then project out those changes and show them, here's what you would look like in 6 months. And so I think there are a variety of companies that are in this area that are relatively simple technical like risks that help sort of what I say, shorten the feedback cycles of human decision-making around things that will make us happier, healthier, or fitter, or stronger. And there are companies that are starting to bubble up, right? There are companies that are now sort of doing this, like, you know, 3D body scanning. There's some companies that are trying to do sort of like at-home health tests, whether it's everything from the biome stuff to the at-home blood tests. But I still think there's a ton of different startups here that can help improve sort of general quality of life by decreasing these feedback cycles and the level of technical innovation that you need to do. It's like all the papers and things are out there. You just need to figure out how to sort of like consumerize and commercialize some of this stuff.
There's sort of a specific technology, which is the automated driving, self-driving cars, artificial intelligence, that's sort of in the world of those things. Brought you in today to talk about transportation in a city. We want to kind of imagine a city in which it works a lot better. Right now in San Francisco, you know, I hop on the bus. I was on the train last night downtown. It's rush hour. We are five bodies deep waiting for the next train to come. It's not coming for 10 more minutes. People are pouring into this in the train station. It just seems like our city government is not able to manage our public infrastructure. Then above ground, there's traffic everywhere. How do self-driving cars help, first of all? And then just paint that picture for me. What does it look like in a sort of technology-enabled city?
I think there's some interesting aspects to like building infrastructure where, you know, Los Angeles did this study where when they like widened one of their highways by like two lanes, I want to say it was like the I-5 or something like that. They actually ended up figuring out that traffic got worse because there was like an induced demand that effectively happened from widening the lanes where more people actually decided to use cars or take trips that they otherwise wouldn't have. You know, I'm definitely in the sort of like Elon camp of this. I'm not sure that, you know, tunnels is necessarily like the right solution, but this problem is effectively impossible to solve in a two-dimensional plane. And you have to sort of introduce a third dimension. And the moment that you introduce a third dimension, this problem becomes infinitely easier. There's a reason why, you know, there's effectively like, you know, no quote unquote air or traffic jams, because if you are, you know, flying on a similar route to another plane, you can just go up another like 300 feet and you're perfectly safe. And so I think in some ways the ideal technology to solve a lot of these problems actually has almost like nothing to do with autonomous cars and has more to do with just the introduction of a Z-axis, and whether via tunnels, more bridges, or the world of kind of like, you know, flying cars, there are much better ways of solving it, I think, actually, than going after like autonomous cars. Like the promise of like, you know, fully autonomous cars somehow perfectly solving like our traffic problems, I think it's going to end up being a sort of like induced demand thing where, you know, let's say before I would have had, let's say like, you know, my kid walk the five blocks from like, you know, his school in the Presidio to my like, you know, house in, you know, Marina. Instead, now I have this autonomous car that I can send around wherever. Well, of course, I'm going to go pick up my kid, right? I want him to be safe on those like five blocks. So now all of a sudden, because like the barrier to entry for these trips is a lot lower, now you're inducing a lot more demand. And so if anything, like the autonomous cars like cause the opposite problem. Nobody's really been able to like obviously study this yet, because none of these, you know, vehicles or companies are anywhere near autonomous driving. But the promise of like, I think autonomous cars solving, you know.
Well, what is the promise of autonomous cars then? I mean, is it just people don't have to drive their own car? It seems like it was much more ambitious a handful of years ago when I first started hearing about self-driving cars.
I think the number one benefit to society is purely going to be on safety. Humans are actually like very good drivers. I mean, we deal with like a lot of particularly difficult anomalous scenarios. I can have a oiler tank fall over in front of me on like the highway and start to burn. And like my brain knows to like, okay, not go in that direction or reverse or figure out how to like, you know, get out of this situation. And I do well in those scenarios. Where I don't do well is like kid cries in the back, cute dog is in the car next to me, girl texts me on my phone. Even, you know, 500 milliseconds of distraction can, you know, cause me to become a horrific driver. And so humans are actually very effective drivers, you know, let's say 99% of the time. It's those 1% where we like have any sort of distraction, because we're, you know, distractible monkeys, that we end up becoming absolutely terrible drivers. And so I see these sort of like promise of self-driving cars more just solving for that like 1%. Ideally, 99% of the time, they're just driving just like a human would. And that 1%, they're also driving like a human would, just, you know, not distractible.
There's nothing in becoming more efficient though, like taking more efficient routes, managing traffic more efficiently. I mean, if every car is a self-driving car and someone is sort of centrally or some AI is centrally operating the flow of traffic, how does that not improve things?
And this is sort of like one of my fundamental disbeliefs in the world of like self-driving cars, where yes, it would be amazing if every single car on the roads was autonomous. And there's tons of interesting things that you could do there. You can, you know, be drafting behind people super closely on a highway, let's say. And there's people that have shown that when you do that with trucks, like massive efficiency gains. There's a reason that semis, human semi-truck drivers tend to do this already. They tend to draft behind one another. But we're never going to be in a world, or not at least for 50 to 75 years, in a world where every single car on the road is autonomous. the refresh rate of the American fleet is incredibly slow. Like the average lifetime of a car is, I don't know exactly off the top of my head, but you know, let's say 12 to 15 years. Even if you were to start to introduce legislation that's suddenly built towards a world where you had to be autonomous, having the average American actually sort of go through and update their car and updating the entire American fleet is not going to happen in like a very particularly like short time frame. Hell, back in the day, the introduction of seatbelts was not an instantaneous thing. Like these things take a ton of time to like flow through. And so the problem is the current sort of like self-driving cars that are being built, a significant amount of them would actually work just fine if every other car on the road operated just like them. Like Cruise would not be having any problems whatsoever if every other car on the road was a Cruise car. And why is that? Well, the way that Cruise's sort of technical stack works is they effectively drive like a robot. Like they're not trying to drive like a human. They have hard-coded effectively like, you know, not entirely, and this is somewhat of a simplification, but like hard-coded quote-unquote rules about how they drive. The problem is humans don't drive with hard-coded rules. We drive with like a series of like intuitions, but we like proactively will like break the rules, right? You have like, you know, you have the, you know, Prius that is the Uber that is like flashing their lights and waiting for a passenger. You will purposely go into oncoming traffic or the oncoming lane to like get around them. And that is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But when you have only cars that drive like robots and perfectly try to follow the rules, the entire system breaks apart. This, in some ways, I think the like core issue that I dig into of what I think a lot of the failure of some of the companies that have gone after autonomous driving in the recent years is they've gone after approaches that sort of would only work if every other car on the road drove like their approach.
I want to go back a little bit, actually. Let's take this to the top of the story. Self-driving cars become a serious conversation, at least publicly, about 5 years ago, I would say. And at that moment, it seemed really inevitable. We had a lot of our huge sort of like tech optimist voices going on and on about how, I mean, this adoption was going to be rapid and like sort of any minute now. It was very reminiscent of the singularity is near conversations I was hearing like 10 years ago in the context of like a general artificial intelligence. But now this goal seemed even more attainable, far less ambitious than creating a consciousness. We haven't actually seen the gains. It seems like we are. And I'm sure this is wrong, and I want you to tell me exactly how I'm wrong, but it seems like we actually haven't gotten any farther along. It seems like when people talked about self-driving cars 5 years ago, they had models working, and there were little self-driving cars from like Google, like sort of zipping around. What technologically have we really achieved in the last 5 years, and why aren't there driving cars, and how long is it going
to
be?
Yeah, I mean, I actually want to extend maybe like the time frame back a little bit even farther, because I think it provides some context to why there's so much optimism. This really all started with the DARPA self-driving car challenge in the late sort of like, you know, 2000s, where the original task was just like drive around basically like a, you know, dirt road in the middle of nowhere and have like the car not crash. And we went from like a bunch of cars that were completely incapable of driving off-road, even on a very simple environment, to they very rapidly increased the complexity of it to eventually like they created a sort of like, you know, fake quote-unquote city and had these cars driving around successfully, admittedly, in completely empty roads. And that was obviously like, you know, pure research. And then you had these companies start to come that were trying to like commercialize it. And then you obviously had like the Google stuff back in like 2015 with like their little demo down in Mountain View. And I think like the sort of extreme optimism came from just like the rate of progress that we were seeing, right? We were seeing from like, you know, 2008, having cars that were like completely incapable of driving in a closed road, off-road kind of test, to things that seemed to be able to like effectively drive around Mountain View. And so it didn't seem that hard to, or that unreasonable to project forward and be like, oh, well, if they're going from not being able to drive on dirt roads to driving around Mountain View, then clearly if we just like extrapolate that rate of progress, we will soon be able to effectively like drive anywhere. And I think this is one of those things where in some ways it actually relates to the parallel of AGI being so close, right? One of my favorite jokes back in the day, which was I think like, it was like Marvin Minsky's lab way back in the day, where he was like, I'm going to take a, you know, group of, you know, my PhD students. I'm going to have them, you know, build a computer that can do like some simple math. It's like, okay, easy. We can do that in 2 weeks. And then he's like, okay. And then I want to be able to give you photos and I want you to recognize whether or not it's a cat. And the PhD is like, okay, give us 40 years. And I think it's like an XKCD comic or something like that. It's like, that also like references this pretty well. And I think in some ways that's sort of like what happened here as well, which was like, we didn't recognize the scale of the problem. Dirt road is at, you know, X or Y equals zero. The Mountain View driving is at Y equals one. And we're like, oh, well then like Y equals two must be where driving downtown and like, you know, San Francisco Market Street and like the wild of that is just Y equals two. Well, actually it turns out it's like Y equals like 2000. Yes, there's some some path to us like eventually getting there. And we are making very significant progress, but we are nowhere near the y equals 2000. We're at like the y equals 2 point on the axis. I think we are going through sort of like the hype curve of autonomous cars. I'd say the peak of it was 2015, 2016, and maybe we're now in like the dearth of it. But there are actually some like very interesting things that are going on that I think are now starting to become highly commercially viable. And the way the approach that these companies are taking is significantly limit the sort of like use case, which then narrows down the engineering problem. So maybe two examples that are sort of like worth discussing here that highlight this particular point. One is this company called Voyage, where they effectively only function in these retirement communities in Florida, where you have these like 120,000 person retirement communities that are pure private communities that have very fixed environments in some ways and fixed weather because they're in Florida. And so there's never any real rain, there's never any real snow. And the hack, or quote unquote hack, that the company has done is said, basically, screw it. We're not going to try to solve the like full autonomy problem where the car entirely on its own is able to figure out how to drive. What we're going to do is, because we know that we operate in a fixed environment, everywhere where we know that there's like a particularly tricky, let's say unprotected left turn where there's like a tree kind of blocking what the car needs to be able to see and makes it really hard to be able to consistently do it 100% of the time. Well, we know that all our cars are only driving this environment. So screw it. We're just going to put a sensor on the street lamp across the street that can then just view what the car is unable to view and solve that problem there. And we're also just going to, since we're in a fixed location, we're just going to run like a teleoperation center that is like monitoring all the vehicles. When anything particularly like if a car starts to, you know, operate outside of its window, we'll just have these like teleoperators basically remote into the car. And we know that we'll be able to like handle the latency because, again, fixed environment. And so by significant training the use case of, we're not going to try and drive anywhere in San Francisco, let's say, we're instead going to drive in a super constrained environment and we're going to put sensors all over this environment. So we're not only relying on the car and we're going to have this teleoperation center that we know is going to have a sub 10 millisecond delay to the cars by massively constraining the use case and introducing all these additional quote unquote resources, they've made it so that they can effectively now drive around this environment. I think it comes down to this like thesis of, again, by massively constraining your use case, you can introduce autonomy into environments that were previously like not thought possible. There's some companies that are now going after this with basically like, you know, semi-truck driving, where if you basically just want to drive on, you know, let's say I-80 between San Francisco and Reno, I mean, you do have, let's say, let's remove the trickiness of like Tahoe and snow. It turns out that problem is much, much more constrained, right? You can now introduce rules such as, you know, San Francisco downtown, when you see sort of an object that's moving in the opposite direction of you, i.e. has like a, you know, negative velocity, you need to be accustomed to that and not treat that as like a freak out scenario. You need to like, you know, be able to track that and be like, okay, that's like oncoming traffic. Versus like when you're on an interstate, if you ever see anything that has negative velocity that is on the same road as you, you can treat that as like a massive red flag and basically like stop the like semi-truck trailer and don't do anything. Or if you see any sort of like object that has horizontal velocity, right? In San Francisco, you need to be accustomed to both, you know, cross traffic coming at you at a red light or a pedestrian stepping out in front of your car or a bicyclist. Versus again, on an interstate, you treat that as a massive red flag event and just immediately stop the car. Or stop the semi-truck. And so I'd say all of the companies that I think are actually doing interesting things on the autonomous side, actually aside from my investment in some ways breaks this particular thesis, but I think it's good to make rules and then also know when to break them, are all basically saying, hey, we're not going to go after the full autonomy problem because that's incredibly difficult to solve. We're going to massively constrain our environment in a variety of different ways. And so there are some that are doing it via taking trucking. There are some that are doing it like Voyage by saying we're going to just operate in one particular environment and massively sort of sensorize that environment. Or there are some that are saying, you know, hey, there's like these yard trucks where when you're driving around a shipping yard, turns out that's, again, a relatively like fixed environment, but having autonomy of those yard trucks is super valuable to those businesses.
Now we're talking about automatic driving on sort of a very typically much more predictable terrain. Mm-hmm. But it's not just, you know, a backlot at Google. It's the real world. And with that comes public opinion and the government then. In a world where just there's one accident, right? It's all it would take is for there to be one moment on an interstate where something really anomalous did happen that the self-driving cars couldn't handle. There was a massive accident. Does it not shut down the industry? How are they thinking about managing what seems like fairly negative public opinion on the stuff right now? I mean, people aren't really friendly towards robots, and we're talking about removing driving from people and handing it directly to the machines.
Yeah, I mean, the unfortunate aspect is, you know, let's say there's 60,000 automobile deaths every single year in the United States. And if you were to roll out autonomous driving, let's say we took that down to 30,000 autonomous or 30,000 vehicular deaths, you unfortunately wouldn't be getting 30,000 thank you notes from the people whose lives you saved.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd be getting 30,000 lawsuits from the people who did actually end up, you know, passing away and, like, you know, their families. Unfortunately, the sort of like bar for autonomous cars is actually significantly higher
I think it's everything. It's not even, it's all technology, period. I mean, we see this with Uber. People are always talking about the assault cases in an Uber, and there's zero conversation about what happens in taxi cabs and what's happened in cabs historically for years. And it's like the scrutiny is just, there's so much more scrutiny for the technology industry in general. And then when it comes down to this specific thing, when it comes down to replacing humans with machines, people really, they lose their minds. Even if it works almost perfectly seems hard to navigate politically.
Yes. And I think the only way that you can both get regulators comfortable and also get the public to trust that you are sort of driving in the appropriate way is to be able to tell the public, look, we have collected and seen billions and billions of miles of data such that we know that in any particular situation that we come up with, it's not actually anomalous to us. We've at least seen some level of how humans react in this particular situation, and our algorithm chose to do what humans did in that particular situation. And so here's what we can show you of prior instances that were effectively the exact same, right? The fear of crashing or doing the wrong thing in an edge case, right, is how I describe what you were saying earlier. You can somewhat mitigate that fear if you say, well, it's not actually an edge case. Here are 15 other examples, and here's exactly what all the humans did in those particular examples. In 7 of them, the humans made the wrong decision and ended up passing away. In 8 of them, here's what they did, and at least like 4 of them were able to survive. So we did the thing where there was at least some survival rate. And so you need to be able to at least make the argument that we, in that particular situation, in that particular edge case, did what a human would have done and did it in the most statistically viable sort of way. And I think that is sort of what will get both the regulators and maybe like the public eventually on board, is saying we drove as a human would have drove. I was sort of describing this a little bit earlier with Cruise, but it sort of gets to the fundamental crux of the thesis behind the investment that we made, which is most of the autonomous car companies that are out there, both the ones that are operating in a constrained environment and like the Cruises and the Waymos and the Zooks of the world, which are trying to operate in this sort of like a free-form environment, don't drive like humans. They try to drive like robots. And why do I say that? Well, it's mostly because of the way that they sort of structure their technical stack or their technical decision-making process, which is most of these companies do use deep learning and machine learning, which I would say is more similar to how a quote-unquote human operates, for understanding the environment around them. So when they're looking around and they say, okay, that's a fire hydrant, that's a human, that's a bicycle, that's another vehicle, they are using deep learning and machine learning for that, which I would say, yes, they are operating like a human in terms of observing the environment around them. After that, though, most of these companies are effectively doing just what I call like rules-based decision-making of, they have actual engineers putting in like, here is what a red light means. When a red light shows up, you have to stop. When the green comes, you start to drive. All of these things are effectively like quote unquote hard-coded by engineers going in and saying, here's what like the rules of driving are. The problem is when you institute a whole large system that's kind of like the state machine that is saying like, here are what the various rules are, the net output is you have a robot driving, right? You have a robot that is like following all these various rules and is a state machine, and that is not necessarily how a human tries to drive.
Right, like you were mentioning earlier, a human in traffic, there's a green light, but there's oncoming traffic. You still would not go.
You still would not go. But most of these autonomous cars by default have the rule built in of just, you know, go. And of course, some of them, you know, might have this hard-coded rule of like, hey, check for oncoming traffic, et cetera. But there's only so many times that you can create a hard-coded rule for all these various edge cases, because the edge cases are just like semi-infinite, right? Yeah. The long tail is super, 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 super long.
A lot like this sort of parable of be careful what you wish for. And I mean, anything that you wish for, you could find some weird rule that spells like sort of catastrophe for whatever it is that you ask for. Like if you don't ask for it specifically right, I mean, you'd have to go down the most granular detail to get it exactly right. And even maybe not even then, which actually brings us to a really interesting question, which is what actually are we doing? Are we following that many rules? What is the human brain? I mean, is it that? Is it just like, are there just like so many more rules than we even are acknowledging? Or you mentioned intuition before.
Unfortunately, we still don't know super well exactly how the brain works, but it seems to be like layers and layers of abstraction that we build in that eventually can get to a sort of maybe core decision-making of, hey, okay, you know, here are these objects, here are where these things are moving, here's what I think is safe versus not safe. But again, that isn't how any of these autonomous cars currently are really effectively built.
And I took us way off track. So, yeah. So you, but the company that you're interested in is sort of what? It's like challenging these I guess, traditions among the...
Absolutely. In some ways, this company, when we first were considering it, was considered heretical in a lot of different ways. I'll segue into this by saying the way that the Cruises and the Zeuxes, et cetera, of the world try to sort of solve this, like, as you were saying, like the parable of a catastrophe, is you see these cruise cars around the city, right? Why are they driving them around? What they're hoping to find are those catastrophic situations such that they can gather data on what that catastrophic situation was, where the robot didn't know what to do, and then figure out, okay, hey, human engineer, go put in the rules so that the robot now knows how to drive in that particular scenario. And eventually that system might work. If they are able to capture billions and billions and billions of miles driven by these like cruise vehicles, then they will eventually be able to encounter all these different scenarios, and eventually the human engineers will have been able to code in rules to capture every single individual run, one of these scenarios, and the robot perfectly reacts to those scenarios. However, right now it's incredibly both expensive and time consuming for Cruise, Zeuxes, Waymo to gather this data on a per mile basis. If the like sort of fundamental equation that I'd say is important for building a self-driving company is essentially your cost of acquisition of data on a per mile basis. And so the way that Cruise and Zeuxes and Waymo, et cetera, work are they have these test drivers in, they have these super expensive like sensor kits that they outfit these cars in. And so the amount that it costs them to go out and look for these parable of catastrophes is actually pretty expensive. It's like $1.50 to $2 per mile driven at minimum to actually try and go out and capture that data to eventually try and find that catastrophic scenario. Our approach was, okay, we use the deep learning and the machine learning for the object recognition and the scenario recognition around this. Why don't we also just use pure deep learning machine learning for the actual decision-making process as well? So screw trying to put in the hard-coded rules of green means go, stop means stop. Instead, let's let the model sort of train on billions and billions of miles driven. And what models and machine learning and deep learning effectively do is they try to emulate the human behavior. So we're not going to say stop is stop. We're just going to say do what humans do at a stop sign or do what humans do at a green light.
I'm confused. So what is the learning process there? How do you learn that? How do you just tell a machine to sort of do what humans would do?
Comes back to one of the recent techniques in machine learning, which is reinforcement learning. What you want to ideally do is go out and capture tons of data and see how humans actually drive. Right. Then what you do is you give the machine learning model, here is the first 2 hours of how somebody drove. Now you drive for the next 10 minutes. And then you compare how the machine drove for the 10 minutes versus how the human actually drove for that like data that you collected. And then you sort of compare the two and you tell the machine, hey, when you drive like the human drove, I'm going to give you points. I'm going to give you positive reinforcement. And then the little, you know, monkey behind the thing goes like, I like positive reinforcement. I'm going to try and emulate this more and more and more. The problem is you want to have enough data such that you can train this thing on a variety of different scenarios, right? You need to be able to train it when the oil tanker, you know, crashes in front of you to when the, like the little toddler jumps out in front of the car. You need to show it that situation and then have it run over the toddler. And you say, no, 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 bad little machine learning monkey model, right? Like that was bad. Yeah. Like show it 15 of those and be like, okay, now you've learned when toddler runs out, you stop, right? Like that means stop. But you need to have at least 15, 20, let's say 30 different instances of a like toddler running out so that it can kind of train itself and learn, okay, I drove bad and you showed me what good was like. So it's like, okay, I'm going to try and drive good next time. Yeah. And then you showed another one. It's like it drove like, okay, right? It's like, no, 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 you got to drive good. Drive like the human drove.
Where are people doing this kind of research? It's not, obviously we're not running over real toddlers. It's
what I would say, every single one of these companies, what they're trying to do is collect enough of a data set on how humans drive in order to try and emulate that. Waymo, Cruise, Zeuxes, et cetera, are taking this approach of like, let's super outfit, let's create this robot, let the robot drive most of the time. And then occasionally we'll intervene and then we'll like hard code the rule. And they're very slowly building up. So like, I think Waymo in their entire time has, I think, drove maybe like 100 million miles or something like that. But like my fundamental thesis or belief is that the like true level of data that you really need is in like the billions of miles, probably like 10 billion miles. Cruise originally started out trying to be like, hey, we're not going to create any hard-coded rules. We're actually going to do the end-to-end approach. And there was actually this project way back in the day done by NVIDIA that was also trying to take the same approach. The company that we invested in is effectively trying to do this, where they're going to say, hey, we're going to do end-to-end machine learning for the entire thing. And the way that we're going to make sure that we're actually driving well in all these various scenarios is collect 10 billion miles worth of data so we can tell you, hey, we have more data than any human has ever been trained on in the world. And we will perfectly react to any quote-unquote edge case, because even in the edge cases, I can tell you I have 20 instances of that quote-unquote edge case that you think is a catastrophe, and my machine learning model has been trained on it. Now, the crux of it, though, is, man, 10 to 20 billion miles, if that costs you $1.50 per mile, like it does for Cruise and Waymo and Zeuxes to collect, that's a lot of money to be spending on collecting data. And Waymo and Cruise and Zoox eventually might be able to get there. But man, spending $20 billion in data collection before you even have a product that you can really release, that's incredibly difficult. So then, okay, what is the fundamental thing that you need to focus on? It's lowering the cost of acquisition per mile of data. So how do you do that? Well, the first thing you need to do is figure out how do you simplify your sensors, right? You can't have a $100,000 sensor kit and have cars driving around with these massive sensor kits. So you have to simplify it. Well, humans are pretty damn good at driving with effectively just two ocular vision sensors. Why not just make it so that the car effectively just relies on that as well? Okay, so you outfit the car with, let's say, 10 different cameras. You have a couple front-facing, a couple side-facing, a couple rear-facing. No LiDAR, no radar, no crazy things. If humans can drive with vision, then we should be able to train a machine learning model to also only drive with vision. Okay, well, how do you convince people to actually, you know, outfit a bunch of cars and drive these around? Well, the first thing that you can go out to a bunch of Uber and Lyft drivers and say, hey, we're going to give you a free, really advanced dash cam. And in exchange, we just want you to have this dash cam running, and you're going to send us some data at the end of each night that is, like, you know, relevant to us. And we're going to have you driving around and collecting this data. Well, yes, you need 10 billion miles to eventually be able to drive in any scenario anywhere on Earth and be able to react to it. But it turns out you actually only need, let's say, like 100,000 miles of driving up and down on like the 280 to be able to say, hey, we've encountered every situation that is possible on the 280 between Sand Hill Road and San Francisco. So then we can do is, rather than just saying Uber and Lyft drivers, we're going to install this as a dash cam into your car, you can now go to the public and say, hey, we have a $5,000 sensor kit that we can install into your car that, yeah, it doesn't have, you know, self-driving everywhere in the world today, but we can at least tell you we can do self-driving between San Francisco and Sand Hill Road. I guarantee you there's a couple of like venture capitalists in the world that would absolutely pay $5,000 to outfit their car to do that. Well, now you have all these venture capitalists that are driving up and down Sand Hill Road, but they also drive to other places too. So now you have the Lyft and Uber drivers that are driving around for the dash cam, these venture capitalists that are driving down. Well, now you're generating even more data. Well, now when you have more data, you can say, oh, I can actually offer any highway in the Bay Area. And so now you go out to a lot of people that are willing to pay $5,000 to do that. And so you set up this virtuous cycle of getting people willing to basically install your kit in their car and collect data for you. And then collecting more data means that now you can offer more and more services or benefits to the people that are willing to install your kit. So now more people are willing to. And so you're actually building up this sort of like network effect flywheel that is eventually getting you to the point where you will have tens of billions of miles of data collected. And the like sort of per mile cost of data collection is actually super, super low. So the clever thing here is in the world of like self-driving, it has been considered heretical to go after this approach because everyone knows that you need $10 to $20 billion of data collected before you can really do the truly end-to-end approach. And the reason why sort of everybody else has given up on this approach up until now has been, I have no clue how to collect that level of data without spending tons and tons of money. And this has been this company's like core insight has sort of been, look, we're now at the point where we can actually just install cameras and start to get this out into people's cars and start to collect this data and start this flywheel that will actually eventually get us to the point of having 10 to 20 billion miles collected.
I mean, this seems reasonable to me. I don't understand why this is not reasonable to the other companies.
One of the partners at Coastal Ventures is this guy, Sven Strobrand. I loved the sort of like investment decision-making process for this company when we were at KV, because both Vinod and this guy Sven have significant sort of background in autonomous cars. He actually built the first car that completed the DARPA self-driving car challenge, and his car is like on display in the Smithsonian. So he's like literally from like the beginning has seen all of the problems and difficulties of building this car. And when the company came in and pitched, he was just like, there's no way. These guys are never going to be able to do it. The level of data they're going to have to collect is just like absolutely insane. Everybody's trying to do this. This is just going to be impossible. But like I questioned him. I was like, okay, like Sven, tell me, like you're technical enough here. You've like literally built self-driving cars. Like, is this technically impossible? Or do you just hate it because so many people have gone after it and effectively failed? And I mean, he kind of fessed up, okay, this isn't technically impossible. Like, yes, if you gave me 20 billion miles of pretty clean data and you had encountered all these various edge cases, yes, technically I could build this. And it's partially because he's been burned by the fact that like so many people have gone after this, but for a variety of different reasons, the ability to make this sensor kit cheap enough, actually having a sort of team that can do this, because there's a variety of very difficult challenges of like being able to retrofit any car for sub $5,000, being able to go convince the like Qualcomms of the world that you should be like producing custom optical chips for them for your use case at a super cheap price. price when like you're only doing like, let's say 1,000 units with the promise of like, hey, eventually we'll do millions. So you should give me the price that you're giving to the iPhone today rather than having to go out and create your own optical chips. There are many reasons why this investment could fail and why this is a particularly difficult problem, but none of them are because this is technically impossible or nobody believes that this could actually eventually be done. It's just very, 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 very hard. And many people have failed at doing it, but it is not like technically impossible to do.
What does San Francisco look like when we finally get this working?
I do think that there's a world where the infrastructure of today just like cannot handle these autonomous cars for a variety of these sort of like induced demand reasons. I do think that this approach could move us more quickly to the world of having lots of autonomous cars on the road, and they can actually like be coordinated with one another, partially because I think this is the only company that's going after the approach of we're going to retrofit effectively any consumer's car that's out there. And so you don't have to wait for that thing that I discussed earlier in the podcast, which is the sort of 15 to 20 years of actually sort of rejuvenating America's fleet. You can actually proactively go after people in their cars. And eventually you could see some world where the government does the you know, pros, cons, benefit, cost analysis of like actually it's worth the government actually paying the $5,000 to retrofit all of these cars and just force it upon consumers because there's actually some net benefit of either, you know, cost savings or just, you know, healthcare savings due to people not getting into these accidents. But, you know, I think there's a world where there are no sort of like automobile-induced pedestrian, bicyclist, or other driver deaths. I used to bike in San Francisco all the time. I effectively no longer bike after, you know, seeing so many people pass away from accidents with vehicles. And so I'm excited for that world.
This is Anatomy of Next.